Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right. Welcome to this week's edition of The Interpreter Show. This week, I am your host, Neil Rapley. I am being joined in studio by the infamous Stephen Smoot, the lovely former Jasmine Jimenez, now Jasmine Rapley. Yes, since the last time we were on, her and I have tied the knot. So we won't make that a subject of discussion today, but just want to celebrate. Yeah. And then joining us by phone here today is Hales Swift.
Well, we have a special edition of our show today. You might call it a birthday edition of the Interpreter Show. As of yesterday, the Interpreter Foundation celebrated 6 years of its existence.
Yes, that's right. Interpreter has been around for 6 years, and so we are the fortunate ones who get to talk about that a little bit. They held a celebration last night, a barbecue. The food was excellent. The company was even better. Wonderful people who have been involved in Interpreter since the beginning, and some who have only joined Interpreter's cause more recently. But yeah, they actually launched 6 years ago at the Fair Mormon Conference in 2012, which was also this week. And we will talk more about this year's Fair Mormon Conference in a moment. But first, we want to just maybe celebrate a little bit about where Interpreter, how they started, and where they've gone.
For our listeners who might not be unfamiliar with the Interpreter Foundation,
For our listeners who might be unfamiliar with the Interpreter Foundation, the Interpreter Foundation is a nonprofit organization who strives to provide information and scholarship on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So if you are interested in having better scripture study and diving in, the Interpreter Foundation has a wealth of resources. They're started out primarily as a journal for publishing articles and book reviews on different scriptural topics, but have since expanded what the organization does. As you now know, they do it in a radio show every week. And they have held conferences in the past and published books, and they just do a wealth of things for enriching people's lives with the scriptures.
As Jasmine just mentioned, you know, they've actually published, in the last 6 years, they've actually published 9 books, to be specific, several of which are their conference proceedings. And over the years, they've held 2 different types of conferences. One has been on temples in the ancient world, a topic that's of great interest to Latter-day Saints. And 3 of the books they've published have been the proceedings of those conferences, including one that has a chapter by our very own Stephen Smoot here.
Yes, but I would recommend that you skip that chapter because it's very boring.
It talks about the Book of Abraham as a temple text, actually.
Good old spicy Book of Abraham, right? Yep. Everybody loves talking about that, especially
these
days.
Well, and I'm sure there was some stuff on the Book of Abraham in the Fair Conference this year, so we're going to probably get some chance to talk a little bit about some stuff related to the Book of Abraham a little later in the show. But I think it's worth mentioning that among the 10 books or 9 books that Interpreter has published is the brand new, hot off the press book, Name as Keyword, by Matt Bowen. He is a biblical scholar who works at BYU Hawaii as a professor in their religion department. Got his PhD in biblical studies at Catholic University of America. And maybe, Stephen, would you like to tell us a little bit about that book, or tell our listeners? I almost said readers. Tell the listeners a little bit about this book and why it's kind of an exciting publication, actually.
Right. So one thing that scholars have begun to recognize in the past little while is that the Book of Mormon contains a lot of what scholars call paronomasia, which is just a fancy word for play on words or puns. But it's not your sort of just typical little, you know, innocent puns that are just lighthearted and fancy-free. These are play on words that are packed with theological or historical significance in the passages that are being discussed or narrated. Typically, paronomasia surrounds the names of figures in scriptural narratives, names of people or places or things like that. And the name of the individual often reflects or draws out or comments on the overall theme or moral of the story in the narrative that's being discussed. And this occurs all throughout the Bible. In fact, it's pretty explicit in many of the biblical stories. Like, for example, when Jacob received his name Israel, the text even says, you know, the angel or the messenger of the Lord says to him, you will no longer be called Jacob, but you will be called Israel because you have struggled with God, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the root of the name, or so it's believed. And so in that case, it's rather overt. But in other cases, it can be either subtle or unspoken, and the only way that you will recognize it is if you are familiar with, say, Hebrew or Egyptian. And so what Matt Bowen has done with his expertise in ancient Semitics and in ancient Near Eastern cultures is he has looked primarily at the Book of Mormon, and he has demonstrated rather persuasively, in my opinion, that a number of the names in the Book of Mormon not only are authentically Hebrew or Egyptian, but they masterfully reflect the narrative moral or the narrative point of the stories in the Book of Mormon that are being narrated or taught. Mm-hmm. So to give you an example, right off the bat in 1 Nephi 1, you have Nephi, and he says, I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents. And throughout his record, he talks about knowing the goodness of God and the goodness of this and that. And so this idea of good or goodness becomes a predominant theme throughout Nephi's narrative. He even ends his record by talking about the goodness of God and so forth in all his days. So there's a theme here. And, well, what do you know? It seems very likely in my estimation and in Matt Bowen's that Nephi's name ultimately derives from the Egyptian word for good or goodly. And so it's literally I, the good guy, the goodly guy, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, and therefore I knew all the goodness of God, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's just mm-hmm. a really quick example of the kind of thing we're talking about that Matt Bowen explores. And there's several instances in the Book of Mormon. I think there's like 10 or 12 chapters in the book that cover different figures or narratives. And it's really a great book to amplify your understanding of these narratives, to dig deeper into the names of these individuals and therefore their character and their significance, and to sort of give a richness and a depth to your study of the Book of Mormon.
Absolutely.
Sounds like a good read. But puns aside, I imagine this book also would serve really well for evidence for the Book of Mormon. I mean, you've got all of these Hebrew names that Joseph Smith would have had to come up with on his own and would have had to create these clever puns. So I'm sure this is going to be a very inspiring read. So it's available on Amazon and at Eborn Books. And yeah, I believe it is currently on the shelves.
Yes, and I think it is worth mentioning. Oh, yes, Hales, go ahead.
It's actually better than that because it's both Hebrew and Egyptian puns. And while Hebrew was known and taught in Joseph Smith's time, Egyptian was still in the process of being deciphered. So it's really hard to make an Egyptian a fake Egyptian pun that year. Anyway.
yes, that year it would have been very hard. I'm sure these days it's quite easy, though.
You know, one thing that I really love is in 1912, there are a number of Egyptologists that turned a very critical eye on the Book of Abraham facsimiles. And one of these Egyptologists, he said, well, you know, it's just, you know, taken for granted. It's just a matter of fact that Joseph Smith, if he was familiar with the Egyptian, would have been totally unacquainted with the system developed by Champollion and scholars in Europe, right? And he was saying this to kind of derisively dismiss Joseph Smith, right, as some yokel that didn't know what he was talking about. But it actually works out really nicely for us because it's like, well, yeah, in fact, he wouldn't have known about proper understanding of Egyptian that was being deciphered by scholars in Europe. So the critics in that regard sort of hoisted themselves by their own petard, if you ask me. sort of dismissing, oh, Joseph Smith could never have known Egyptian. This is absurd. Well, you know, then you have to account for all the Egyptian stuff in the Book of Mormon.
Right. And so, yeah, so to just provide a few details about the book itself, it's got 16 chapters, probably, I would roughly 12 or 13 of which are specifically on Book of Mormon word plays and names, and as we've already discussed, these are playing off of the Hebrew and Egyptian meanings of these names. If you don't know those languages, you don't see these word plays, you can't write these word plays into the Book of Mormon. And so this is pretty compelling evidence, I think, that the original language of the text was, or the original authors of the text knew Hebrew and Egyptian. The last few chapters deal primarily with biblical puns and word plays, and that's some good stuff as well. And so we would definitely recommend that book published by the Interpreter Foundation, who sponsors the show, obviously. And that's just the latest thing, obviously, coming off the presses from the Interpreter Foundation. For the last 6 years, on a weekly basis, they have published an academic journal article. Some weeks they've done two and even fewer weeks, but still it's happened on occasion. They've actually published three articles that week.
And I believe at the dinner last night, Dan Peterson, the founder and chairperson, I believe, of the Interpreter Foundation, announced that, yes, because they've consistently published at least one article a week, it's been over 360 weeks consecutively that they've been able to publish an article. And he mentioned that starting out, they just thought, well, we'll make a big splash and publish one article a week for a while, but then probably we'll have to tone it back since we won't be able to handle it, or maybe people won't be submitting articles. But no, there's just been a flood of people continually submitting articles, continually providing us as readers with a wealth of information on the scriptures. And it's been remarkable what they've been able to accomplish in the last 6 years.
Absolutely. And the result of that consistent publishing over the last 6 years is they've now compiled 28, and they're finishing or working on finishing the 29th volume of the Interpreter Journal. And so 29 volumes of roughly probably ranging between 200 and over 300 pages sometimes of scholarship and insight on Latter-day Saint scripture and history. So lots of great material and study resources just in the journal alone. And as we've already mentioned, they're doing a lot more than that.
And it's important to note that as a nonprofit, they run primarily on volunteers, and the people work very hard to make this happen. But as a nonprofit, donations are always needed. So if you're in a position to help, we would very much appreciate it. Currently, we're working on a documentary on the witnesses that we'd love to push forward. But that, as well as the journal, as well as these conferences, and as well as publishing books, has overhead. And so every little bit helps.
Yes, absolutely. Is there anything else anybody wants to say about the Interpreter Foundation before we switch gears just a little bit here?
I think we're good.
I guess I've got one comment, which would be, even if you're not maybe as much of a reader, but maybe are into the audio formats as evidenced by the fact that you're listening to this show, whether on the radio or later as the podcast, you should be aware that all of the articles are also made available as audio, so you can go to the podcast stream, which is, I believe, Audio Podcast of the Interpreter Foundation, something like. What's the official name of that?
I am not sure what the official name is, but I know that if you just go to the Interpreter Foundation and go to any paper you'd like, on the sidebar to the right, you can click. There's an option to click. MP3 audio, and you can just click on that as an article format to look at, and it will open that up, and you can listen right there.
That is a great point, because I enjoy the Interpreter articles, but I've got to say, I don't remember the last time I actually read one. I usually listen to them because I, can multitask. I'm a millennial. That's what we do.
It lets you improve the morning commute with some scholarship.
Absolutely. And be aware that if you choose to consume the Interpreter articles in that format, you may sometimes be greeted with the soothing tones of Hales' voice, because he's recorded some of those.
But anyway, let's move on to the FAIR conference. So the Interpreter Foundation was founded at the end of the FAIR conference, but we will get back to that after the break.
All right. Please hang on with us. All right. right, welcome back to the Interpreter Show. This week we have here in studio myself, Neil Rapley, Stephen Smoot, and Jasmine Rapley. And joining us by phone is Hales Swift. Just before the commercial break, we mentioned that this week was the Fair Mormon Conference. Now, a little background on Fair Mormon what they do. They've been around for 21 years, actually, and this was the 20th anniversary conference, the 20th conference they've held annually for the last, obviously, 20 years. And they are an apologetic organization. Of course, apologetics is kind of a confusing word for a lot of people. It just means to defend what you believe in. In this case, they're defending the beliefs of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they have a very close relationship with the Interpreter Foundation. In fact, it was 6 years ago at the Fair Mormon Conference that Dan Peterson, the founder of Interpreter, announced the founding of Interpreter. So there's a close relationship there, and every year when the Fair Conference comes around, Interpreter also celebrates its birthday or its anniversary. And at this point, the two organizations, along with Book of Mormon Central, which all three of us here in studio work for Book of Mormon Central, and Hales actually also does some volunteer stuff for us at Book of Mormon Central. So Fair Mormon, Interpreter, and Book of Mormon Central are all affiliated organizations under an umbrella group called Mormon Voices. And so a very close relationship here. Why don't we go ahead, though, and give a quick overview. This year's conference, typically the Fair Mormon Conference is a two-day event. This year it was a three-day event. It was held Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Jasmine, why don't you go ahead and start by giving us an overview of the first day.
The Wednesday session of the Fair Mormon Conference may have been, I don't know, the least anticipated, but ended up being, in my opinion, the most impressive session of the conference. You had speaker after speaker giving perspective and voices of Mormon women in Mormon history, and also Latter-day Saints today who are living the gospel across the world. There were seven speakers on the Wednesday, and all of them gave different perspectives on Mormon women throughout history and throughout the world today. Matthew McBride started out speaking about women of the global church, and he talked about stories on history.lds.org. He works for the church history department, and they are working on creating global histories that can be available in your gospel library app. And those are short little essays or articles about different countries across the world that are involved in the church. Jenny Reeder talked about her title of her presentation was Fire in My Bones, Women's Stories on ChurchHistoriansPress.org. Another representative of the church coming and talking about the stories of pioneer Mormon women and early church history Mormon women and all of their struggles. We also had Lisa Olson Tate. She talked about the Gospel Topics essays, and she took the perspective of women's voices in the Gospel Topics essays. The Gospel Topics essays have several essays that involve women, including Joseph Smith's polygamy, women in the priesthood, and Heavenly Mother. And so she took her perspective on that. Jenny Lund is a church historian, and she talked about a pioneer early Utah settler polygamist, or not polygamist wife, but a regular Mormon wife.
She dreaded becoming
polygamy.
Wife. She dreaded
Sainey Lund was her name. She talked all about her story. Scott Hales was coming from the church history department and discussing the new church history volume Saints and the women's stories that are going to be featured there. Towards the end of the day, we had Tonalyn Rutherford talking about Mormon women in India. And here she talked about her studies as she went over to travel to India and study the stories of Latter-day Saints today, how they incorporate Mormon culture in their native Indian culture and how it affects them, how it clashes with their culture, how it melds with their culture really well, and really fascinating coverage of that. And finally, at the end of the day, Lynn Hilton Wilson talked about Peter and Paul's passages on women. And these are the ones that tend to get a lot of attention for being misogynist or chauvinistic, talking about women having to be silent in church or women having to cover their heads. And she kind of addressed those, trying to unpack it a little bit and contextualize it in a way to help us understand how there's a lot more to the story. And so that pretty much summarizes, in general, what happened on Wednesday.
All right. Stephen, maybe you would like to tell us about day two really quickly?
Well, day two this year is normally day one of the other fair conference years.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time they had an extra day. And unlike the first day, which was all themed around women and Mormonism, this was a little more eclectic with just a bunch of random different talks on different subjects running throughout the day. Some scriptural, some historical, some sort of apologetic. So it began with Sarah Riley, who her husband Jonathan works at Book of Mormon Central, and Sarah is a volunteer at Book of Mormon Central. And Sarah spoke on the subject of the use of the Exodus narrative in Mosiah 11 through 18.
Mm-hmm.
What she demonstrated rather insightfully is that the account of Limhi's people and then King Noah's people, or I should say Elma's people who fled from King Noah and so
mm-hmm.
forth, that whole narrative right there in the middle of Mosiah draws on much of the language and imagery and themes of the Exodus of Moses and the Israelites from Egypt. And there are clear intertextual relationships between the two texts, and what she basically showed was a very sophisticated and robust understanding and use of the biblical material in the Book of Mormon. After she spoke, Brad Wilcox, he's the popular LDS speaker and educator at BYU, he spoke on the subject of have you been saved by grace? How do we respond? This is more sort of geared towards interactions with predominantly evangelical Christians who are often concerned with how Mormons understand grace and whether we're saved by grace and what Mormon theology has to say about that. But also Brad Wilcox was attempting to correct some of the misperceptions or misunderstandings that are within Mormon culture and Mormon discourse when it comes to salvation by grace. He made the point that we do in fact believe that we're saved by grace. That's rather overt in our scriptures. Rather, however, it's not a grace as evangelical Protestants may understand it. It's also not a grace as it's popularly sort of thrown around casually by Mormons. And so he had some thoughts there. After Brad Wilcox, there was Steve Densley and Garrett Giles, who presented a talk called Barriers to Belief. And this one was rather, I want to say kind of spicy, right? Kind of controversial in a sense. It's going to get people excited, I think, when they hear it. Basically, what these two guys showed was, they deconstructed the narrative you often hear from those who leave the church or from those who encourage others to leave the church, that it's just a simple matter of fact that, I discovered the truth, capital T, about Mormonism being false, and so I just left in a purely rational thinking, logical mode, right? Rather, they show sociological and psychological data suggesting that emotional and mental health issues can play a factor in people deciding to either leave the church or stay within the church or a religion, any religion in general. Now, they were quick to point, for example, those who experience obsessive compulsive disorder or those who experience manic depression or those mm-hmm. who have sort of mental health issues like this, sort of statistically speaking, are more likely to leave a religious tradition, including Mormonism, and turn their back on that. Now, they were very quick to point out that they are not saying that people who leave the church are just therefore mentally handicapped, right, or mentally ill, right? They were saying that that can be a component in some people's decisions to leave the church, and therefore we as members of the church should be aware of that and should respond with compassion and love when those who do have mental health challenges may show signs of this. It was a very nuanced approach, so be careful not to misunderstand them, but it was important to bring up this factor, I felt.
And, I mean, just to interject really quickly, I think it is important to note that they weren't bringing this up as a means of discrediting people who leave.
Right.
But more as a means of, let's understand why people leave so we can better minister to them and hopefully meet their needs better so that they don't leave, so that they feel included, they feel taken care of.
Exactly.
They feel like they're part of the community.
So, for example, they quoted a woman researcher, who Jana Reese, who is doing some statistical surveys of those who leave Mormonism or stay in Mormonism, and the number one cited reason for leaving Mormonism, according to the survey, as Jana Reese, was people said, I felt shamed or guilted over something I had done, or I felt judged, mm-hmm. right? I felt excluded from the group. That is a mental health or an emotional response to something that needs to be taken into consideration when ministering and reaching out to those. And so, yes, that was the main point. Not to say, well, ex-Mormons are just, you know, mentally feeble or whatever, and that's why right. they left, but rather right. to say, this can be a component that we need to acknowledge in many cases, and so here's how we can respond to that positively.
Mm-hmm.
But, sorry, Hales, did you want to say something?
Well, sure. I would add to that that one of the reasons why scholarship, history, sociology even, are worthwhile is because it helps us to have compassion on people. When we understand people, we can better imagine what it might be like to be in their situation, whatever that might be, and we can better relate to them and love them. So I think that is, that should definitely be a goal of all learning, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So after Steve Densley and Garrett Giles was Jeff Bradshaw. Jeff has been a longtime associate with the Interpreter Foundation. I believe he's on their board of directors, as a matter of fact,
yes,
or their executive board.
He recently went on a mission to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is what he also talked about.
Right.
But prior to leaving, I know he was vice president of the Interpreter Foundation, and he's
he's still there. Yeah, and he's very present. And he, you know, he was there for the past, I believe, 2 or 3 years or so mm-hmm. as a senior missionary with his wife. And he just shared stories of their experience over there, what the church is like in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, how the saints are, what their challenges are, what their faith stories and what their testimonies are like.
Just one comment on that, since it is Fast Sunday. One of the parts of his address that really struck me and humbled me and made me appreciate my own situation is when he went down there and they're trying to teach the members who are so faithful and so ready to accept the gospel, the law of the fast, and how to fast on Fast Sunday. We teach, you know, it is 2 meals or 24 hours, and so as Americans, we can barely make it to after our block. We go home and we gorge ourselves. Well, for these faithful members, so often, on a regular basis, they only eat one meal a day if they're lucky. And so for them, they're going down there and they're realizing that these saints are fasting for up to 48 hours just
because
so they can make sure they get their two fasted meals.
Because they're
in.
Told, yeah, they're told 2 meals to fast for, and so they end up fasting 48 hours thinking they've got to skip 2 meals.
I mean, what faith.
Yeah, beautiful. And for the record, they corrected that and helped them understand, no, you only need to fast
right.
1 day.
Right, so there were some wonderful stories or anecdotes like that one that Jeff relayed to the conference. After Jeff spoke, John Gee, an Egyptologist down at BYU, spoke. Professor Gee, of course, is very well known for his work on the Book of Abraham, and he spoke on the topic of selling our birthright for a mess of pottage, the historical authenticity of the Book of Abraham. And Professor Gee made some comments in his, well, before we get to that, the overall point of his argument or his talk was to say that Latter-day Saints should not quickly abandon faith or belief in the historical reality, or sometimes called the historicity, of the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham. There's a trend in some academic or intellectual circles within Mormonism to downplay or discredit the historical reality of these books of Scripture for the sake of maintaining its sort of theological or literary, prestige, right? The idea being that, well, we have an archaeologically verified Zarahemla, or there's other problems with the Book of Abraham, but so we should just disregard that and just focus on these books as inspirational in mm-hmm. a sort of vague sense mm-hmm. of it's like theologically rich or it's literarily rich or what have you. And John Gee argued against that. He argued for the importance of actually maintaining belief in the historical reality of these books. But he, as I affectionately say, he started World War III on the internet with some of his comments, because he took direct critique of some recent efforts by some Mormon scholars to elevate what's called the documentary hypothesis, just to get out of that quickly, it's the idea that the Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses, were not authored by Moses himself, but were rather the result of centuries of scribal redaction and editing of
right.
different sources. Some Mormon scholars have tried to argue that the documentary hypothesis should be valued greater than the historical claims of the Book of Abraham, and that in fact the documentary hypothesis questions or brings into question claims of the historical reality of the Book of Abraham and the Book of Mormon. And John Gee took great exception to that, and he made one sort of line that kind of set the internet abuzz when he said, just so y'all know, there's more archaeological evidence for the Book of Abraham than there is for the documentary hypothesis.
And we can circle back around to unpack that a little bit.
Later.
I think that'd be a good discussion. But let's get through
the rest. Yeah, sorry about that.
Rundown here.
I'll actually, you know what? I'll confess, I wasn't there for Randall Spackman's talk. I was having a conversation out in the hall during that one. So I'm going to let Neil, our resident Book of Mormon chronologer, take over here and tell us a little about this one.
Well, so I guess I'll just wrap up day two and get us started on day three for the rundown here then. Randall Spackman is probably the foremost thinker on Book of Mormon chronology at this point in time, and he offered he spoke on the chronological structure and symbolism in the small plates, and he essentially argued that there's a pattern to the way chronological markers are being talked about and mentioned in the phrasing and the wording that's being used every time chronology comes up and when it comes up in the small plates. There's a pattern to that, and that pattern is a result of Nephi's deliberate patterning in 1st and 2nd Nephi, and then subsequently his command to the rest of his descendants to continue in that pattern. But we will discuss day 3 when we get back on the Interpreter Show. Welcome back to the Interpreter Show. We have been, for the last little bit, giving a brief rundown of the Fair Mormon Conference that was this week. It was this year a 3-day event. And we just gave a rundown of day one and most of day three. Or most of day two, excuse me. The final presentation on day two was Spencer McBride. He talked about Joseph Smith's interactions with, and the saints' interactions more broadly, with the Van Buren White House and also Congress and the Senate during that time. And lessons we can kind of learn about religious freedom and politics in light of some of those events. And that was actually a very, very interesting presentation. Spencer McBride is currently working on a book on these topics, and so he's done some very thorough research there. Day three, Friday, the final day, also had some excellent presentations, and we'll just go through them really quickly because we'd like to come back around and discuss some of the topics that were covered throughout the conference with a little more depth here. But the first speaker was Wade Miller, a professional geologist and paleontologist who presented on pre-Columbian horses in America. And he gave a very thorough accounting of the history of the horse all the way back down to the Pleistocene epoch and even much earlier than that, to the origins of the horse and on, and discussed some evidence that we're beginning to get now that the horse survived, excuse me, much later than has been typically thought, and possibly even into Book of Mormon times. And so if we get a chance later on in the show, we'll discuss that in a little more depth, but some potentially game-changing evidence that he's been uncovering down in Mexico, actually. The next speaker was John Lynch, and he talked about the importance of, the title was Strengthening Thy Brethren, and it was about the importance of lifting up and strengthening those who want to believe but are going through something of a faith crisis. And his presentation was also very good. But the big keynote, the big probably not just for day three, but for the whole conference. The big keynote speaker, if you will, was actually Elder Kevin W. Pearson of the First Quorum of the 70, who came and addressed. This is a landmark experience, first time in 20 years that a general authority has spoken at the Fair Mormon Conference. And he gave a strong address on the importance of having independent voices speaking up in defense of the church and promoting good causes and gospel-related causes and things like that online especially and on social media, and the importance of organizations like Fair Mormon and like Interpreter and like Book of Mormon Central. In fact, he named those three specifically in the Q&A when he was asked, what kinds of organizations are you talking about? The importance of the things they're doing online. And we'll definitely want to come back and talk a little bit more about that. But Jeff Lindsay was the next speaker, and he talked about dust-related terminology in the Book of Mormon and some various ways it ties into ancient Near Eastern concepts and related ideas and some of the literary motifs that are used around dust. And it was a very insightful presentation. Another highlight, though, was the next presentation by Steve Harper, who talked about the making of saints, meaning the volume saints, the church history saints, that is coming out in a month from now, September 4th, being published by the church. It's a four-volume history, and Steve Harper has been kind of the general editor of that history up to this point, and he gave a really great rundown of the things that have been going on and what's gone into writing and producing that. We'll want to talk about that a little later. Last two presentations of the conference, though. Jeff Robinson on thinking differently about same-sex attraction. And I have to confess, like Stephen did yesterday, I was in a meeting during that presentation, so I missed that one.
But I can comment on that briefly. Jeff Robinson is a marriage and family therapist of 25 years, and the title of his presentation was Thinking Differently About Same-Sex Attraction. And his point was that so often in the church and outside of the church in secular circles, we talk about homosexuality, same-sex attraction, and what causes it. Is it something you choose, or is it something you're born with? And he wanted to kind of shift that paradigm. And he argues in his presentation that it's not something you choose exclusively. It's not something you're born with exclusively. But what if you think about it as something you know how to do? And that's a loaded phrase that would definitely need unpacking. If we have time, we can talk about it. But if we don't get to some of these presentations, we do want you to know that you can go on fairmormon.org and still pay for streaming of some of these of all of these presentations. And the transcripts of all of them should be available online in the near-ish future.
The analogy that he used in his talk to discuss this that may help our listeners understand what he meant, Professor Robinson or Dr. Robinson meant by it's something you know how to do, is he compared it to knowing a language. So when you grow up as a little baby learning English, you just like learn it instinctually, right? Your native primary language, even if you're totally illiterate, you know how to speak it at least. And you just learn that through exposure to it and through just learning it intuitively how to do it. And he likened, you know, and so he is the example of trying to like unlearn English if you're a native English speaker, right? Or trying to imagine not knowing how to speak English, right? And so he compared that with homosexuality or same-sex attraction. He said there are some individuals who simply know how to do this like instinctively, he said, the same way they know how to like instinctively speak their native language. Mm-hmm. So maybe just a little framing way to help make sense of it, but definitely check it out on the website if you can, and if we have time, maybe we can explore it a little further.
Absolutely. And the final speaker at the conference was Dan Peterson, again, if we haven't mentioned enough times, founder and president of the Interpreter Show here, and he spoke on the what, why, and how of apologetics, and really kind of stressed that apologetics is something we all do. It's just a defense of things you believe, really. Talked variously about why we do it, how we should do it, approaching it with humility and grace, positive, negative apologetics, and various things like that. And now, as Jasmine already mentioned, If any of this interests you, and we're not going to be able to get to all of it or discuss all of it, but if any of this interests you and you didn't already attend or watch the conference, you can go to fairmormon.org and you can still purchase streaming. I believe it's $25. You can purchase streaming, and then you get access to the videos of all of the presentations, and you can watch any one of these presentations you like or all of the presentations. That's something you can still do, and that'll be available for the next little while, and in the near future, I should say, Fair Mormon will be getting transcripts of all these presentations up online as well. So let's maybe circle back around to some of the highlights now, starting with on the Women's Day, we mentioned Lisa Olson Tate. She talked about takeaways from the gospel topics essays. And that was something I know all of us in studio here when we were there at the conference, we really enjoyed that presentation for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons we think it was important is because she stressed the fact that she was not only was she coming from as an employee of the church and speaking kind of as a representative in this case, but she stressed the fact that the gospel topic essays are intended to be official church statements. They don't have an author or byline because they're not meant to be statements from an individual. They're meant to be statements from the church.
In fact, here is mostly a paraphrase, but I was trying to write down as closely as possible what she said. She says, the gospel topics essays received review and input from top leadership of the church, including the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the First Presidency. Rarely are published works by the church given such oversight by the highest level of leadership. People in the past have tried to dismiss the validity of the gospel topics essays as simply a public relations statement, but they were intended from the beginning to express the official stance of the church. The gospel topics essays are church statements, and she was very emphatic about that.
Right. And so I think maybe it's worth just opening up the discussion at this point. What are the implications of that that reality?
Well, the gospel topics essays deal with some pretty controversial issues or issues that people have had questions about or doubts about in the church. And so they didn't shy away from anything. They tried their best to explore the issues, to provide faithful answers to them. And so for Lisa Olson Tate to come out and say that these are absolutely the official stance of the church, this is what we believe, this is what we want our church members to be reading and understanding, it means it's a new chapter in the church in a lot of ways. I mean, it opens up an embracing of some of these controversial issues. It opens up discussion. That means at church, in Sunday school, we should and can be talking about them and using these gospel topics gospel topics essays as resources.
Right. And I think what's actually maybe a really important takeaway is a lot of people have kind of dismissed these essays. They've done it for different reasons. Some are critics outside the church who want to dismiss them as, you know, just PR statements or whatever, because they want to be able to continue to insist that the church is shying away from these or is otherwise not addressing things as directly as it can. But unfortunately, there's some actually in the church who have wanted to dismiss these for various reasons, lots of times because they've come to hold certain views about the topic, say DNA in the Book of Mormon or on the translation in the Book of Mormon. I've talked to some people who take issue with that essay and some of these other ones. They've come around to certain views and they disagree with what's been said in the essay, and so they really want to undermine or downplay the significance of these essays. And so I think it's important to realize Lisa Tate stressed that these have received more vetting from the highest levels of the church, meaning First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 Apostles, than most church publications have. And I've seen people who literally will hold the manuals up as some kind of doctrinal standard, nonetheless dismiss these essays as something kind of off to the side that's not important, when in all likelihood, actually, these essays have been vetted more closely by the First Presidency than Emmanuel has.
And before we get any further, I do want to back up a minute for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Gospel Topics essays. The Gospel Topics essays are articles, essays written by the official church that discuss controversial topics such as Joseph Smith's polygamy, blacks in the priesthood, women in the priesthood, Heavenly Mother, and other things that have brought drawn a lot of questions and doubts from members. And these Gospel Topics essays you can find right in your Gospel Library app and on the church website. On your Gospel Library app, they're found under the Church History section. If you open up the app, click on Church History, Gospel Topics essays is going to be one of the first things you see. And those are meant to be a resource for Latter-day Saints in lessons, in personal study, in missionary work, in all sorts of ways. And I absolutely agree and echo you, Neil, that they have received very close vetting, and they're intended to be wonderful resources for us to learn and to embrace our history a little more.
Absolutely. So we maybe... Okay, so anything else that is maybe worth highlighting real quick about that first day?
Well, that honestly was only her introduction to her talk that we really like to dwell on. But she talked in more detail about specifically the woman and the priesthood essay. I believe the yes. essay is called Joseph Smith's Teachings on Priesthood, Temple, and Women. And she wanted to take a women's perspective because this was the Women's Day of Affair Conference, but she didn't want to focus on polygamy or Heavenly Mother as much because that has been addressed elsewhere.
She did spend some time talking about Heavenly Mother.
That is true, yes. And so she spent time kind of unpacking the essay and talking about what it means to have the priesthood and how it might have meant something very different in the 1830s, how it should... Today we see priesthood as something that is ecclesiastical and official in nature, but in the 1830s, Joseph, when he established the Relief Society, talked about giving them priesthood authority, and he even gave unto them keys to officiate in the Relief Society. And so he clearly had a large umbrella in mind when he was talking about the priesthood.
Excellent, thank you. When we come back, we will continue our discussion of the 2018 Fair Mormon Conference and the various topics discussed there. This is The Interpreter Show.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, and we are back here at The Interpreter Show. I am, this week, I am your host, Neil Rapley. I'm joined in studio by Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley. And then we have, joining us by phone, Hales Swift. And we're discussing the various topics and presentations from the 2018 Fair Mormon Conference that was held just this last week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And if you'd like to join us in this discussion and talk about, we've given an overview of the conference so far. If you'd like to join us on any of the things we're discussing relative to that conference, you're welcome to give us a call at 801-254-1640, and we'd love to get your thoughts on some of the things that were presented there at the Fair Conference and some of the topics that were under discussion. Earlier, Stephen Smoot gave us a summary, a brief rundown of John Gee's presentation on the Book of Abraham, and mentioned that there has been some controversy surrounding some of John Gee's remarks. So we wanted to actually dive into that right now and discuss and maybe unpack what he said a little bit, discuss some of the controversy. I think a lot of it comes from misunderstanding the point Dr. Gee was actually trying to make. But real quick, the statement he made that has stirred the pot a little bit was, there is more archaeological evidence for the Book of Abraham than there is for the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis being a predominant paradigm for understanding the first five books of the Bible among biblical scholars at present. So, Stephen, why don't you maybe break this down for us a little bit and tell us a little bit more about the controversy here.
Right. So Professor Gee framed his discussion by noting that there are four predominant paradigms in the discussion around the Book of Abraham today. The first is that the Book of Abraham is modern and that it is fraudulent. That is, it's a fabrication just made up by Joseph Smith. And he said that's predominantly the view held by non-Mormons when they think of the Book of Abraham. The second paradigm is that the Book of Abraham is modern, but that it is inspired scripture. And so even though it does not have historicity, and it is a modern fabrication, it nevertheless is inspired scripture. The third paradigm is that the Book of Abraham is ancient, but it is ancient fiction, and yet still historical. So in other words, it was not written by Abraham, but it was written by somebody in the ancient world, an unnamed or anonymous ancient Jewish author, and that it is scriptural. And then finally, the position, and this is one that Dr. Gee holds to, is that the Book of Abraham is authentically ancient. That is, it was written by Abraham and is a authentically historical text, and that it is inspired. These are the four positions people usually stake, one of these four at least. And the rest of Dr. Gee's talk was to give his views on why he felt that the fourth paradigm was the most, or was the strongest one, was the one most credible. And in doing that, he had to address some of the criticisms that have been made against his paradigm or against his position, such as the belief or the argument that the documentary hypothesis, which we just mentioned, is evidence against the historical authenticity of the Book of Abraham. The argument goes like this. Moses did not author the first five books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible. Rather, these books were composed over a series of centuries by scribes utilizing different documentary sources to weave together a coherent, structured book or narrative. That not a single person named Moses did not just sit down sometime around 1200 BC, let's say, and just crank this all out at one time. If that's the case, then this is problematic for the Book of Abraham, because the Book of Abraham has a very clear affinity with the Book of Genesis and its account of Abraham, specifically the account of Abraham's wanderings and the creation account, the creation account in Genesis 1, I should say. And so because the Book of Abraham has a relationship with the material in Genesis, the argument goes that the Book of Abraham could not have been written by Abraham in Abraham's day, because this is anachronistic material that does not belong to Abraham's day. It belongs many, many centuries later.
And I think specifically the idea that the narrative as we have it draws from what source critics today would break into separate sources in the documentary hypothesis.
Yes.
And so the argument goes, it must have come after those sources were brought together, and therefore must be later than, you know, the Book of Genesis, basically.
Right, right. So
the argument is assuming that that information would not be available in Abraham's time period, the later invention, and so Abraham can't possibly have said something similar.
Right, right.
So that's the basic argument made by scholars such as David Bakavoy, who has published on this. He's an LDS biblical scholar who has been very skeptical of traditional LDS views of the Book of Abraham. If I'm not mistaken, Professor or Dr. Bakavoy, he believes that the Book of Abraham is modern but scriptural. It's inspired scripture, but it's modern. It's a modern, if you want, probably not fabrication, you wouldn't say, but a modern midrash or a revelation by Joseph Smith or what have you, but it's not historical to the time of Abraham.
So that would be, of the four positions
that would be the second
outlined
position.
Yeah, by Gee, that would be position number two.
Yes, and David Bakavoy has championed the documentary hypothesis as evidence for this position. So to refute this or to address this argument, Professor Gee didn't specifically name David Bakavoy, but he at least addressed his argument. This has been held by others and articulated by others. But he said, well, the documentary hypothesis may be widely accepted by some LDS biblical scholars and amongst most non-LDS mainstream biblical scholars. However, he said, there's little to no archaeological evidence verifying it, whereas there is archaeological evidence verifying the contents of the Book of Abraham. Therefore, the Book of Abraham trumps the documentary hypothesis in terms of what we should give precedence to, or what we should give place our confidence in. In other words, we should place our confidence in a historical Book of Abraham and not in the documentary hypothesis, because there's archaeological confirmation for the former, whereas there's no archaeological confirmation for the latter.
Right. And so this naturally, this got quite a rise out of or a reaction from Bakavoy on social media and others. And I think the biggest part of their reaction is that because the documentary hypothesis is a literary and a textual and a source critical theory, rather than a question of necessarily archaeology, we shouldn't expect archaeological verification. It's kind of the wrong tool in their minds for this. They've also, some of what we've seen online has been the reaction that the only archaeological evidence there is for the Book of Abraham is what's supported by archaeology in Genesis anyway, and where the Abraham narrative and the two overlap. And so it doesn't really have any kind of independent archaeology. And so I think maybe from this point, let's maybe first address in what ways could archaeology meaningfully come to bear on questions about the documentary hypothesis, for one. And then number two, maybe how has archaeology come to bear on the Book of Abraham in ways that are different from or independent from the Genesis narrative?
Right. Yeah, those are some good things to discuss. So let's look at the first question. I am particular to a school of thought by an archaeologist named William Deaver, who does a Syro-Palestinian archaeology, sometimes called in popular discourse, quote, archaeology of the Bible, end quote, although that's not really what he's doing, but it usually overlaps.
And in fact, Deaver
very vehemently says that's not what he's doing.
Rejects that label. Yeah.
But he is doing archaeology related to the Bible, you might say.
Yes.
And he's looking at the material culture of the biblical world, biblical lands, and trying to correlate it or converge it with what is described in the biblical texts. So William Deaver has made the argument that texts themselves can act as archaeological artifacts and as archaeological witnesses to addressing a historical question. He, in other words, does not think that there is a neat distinction between a literary text as its own thing as opposed to archaeological artifacts. He thinks that the two converge with each other, and the role of the historian for Professor Deaver is to find that convergence by utilizing both the textual and the non-textual artifacts. So how this might apply to the documentary hypothesis would be in the following scenario. Let's say that next week, archaeologists digging in Jerusalem uncover a cache of papyri or ostraca previously unknown with texts or inscriptions on them, and they translate them, and it turns out that these are discrete literary units which documentary hypothesis advocates claim are one of the separate strands of the sources used in the Pentateuch. So, for instance, when documentary hypothesis advocates carve up Genesis into different sources, they typically say this chunk is from the E source, meaning the Elohist source, the source that uses the name Elohim for God, whereas this portion is the Yahwist source because it uses the name Yahweh or Jehovah for the name of God. Now, let's say we discovered next week a cache of papyri that has only the, quote, E source, right, that only has those passages talking about El and Elohim and these sorts of things.
And let's just, for the sake of this hypothetical, let's say that these are the earliest manuscripts any biblical text we've ever found. They predate anything we have by centuries.
Right. Let's say we can, through whatever means, we can date them to, like, the 9th century B.C., let's say.
Right, sure.
That would actually go, it wouldn't prove the documentary hypothesis, but it would go a far way in demonstrating the plausibility of this idea that the E source is the earliest source, that it's a discrete literary unit, that it has discrete literary elements or sort of source elements in it, and we see this on its own. Like, it's been independently verified to an extent, right? That there was this, quote, E source. Now, that's a very kind of far-fetched scenario since no documentary hypothesis advocates are expecting this. But let's just say it happened. This would be, to a degree, archaeological confirmation for the documentary hypothesis. You could show, as many of these theorists argue, there's the source E, it's super early, and it's its own discrete literary thing, its own literary source, right? In that way, the archaeology could potentially verify the documentary hypothesis, right?
Right.
In other words, you could potentially discover the Book of E, let's say.
Sure.
You know, as
sure.
opposed to all of the Book of Genesis, which is much later.
And that's a fairly direct type of way that archaeology could provide evidence for the documentary hypothesis. And like we said, this isn't proving it. It's true. You could come up with some other explanation. Someone, after the full text was written, extracted these narratives for some reason or another. But that would be viewed, I think, highly skeptically by not only most, by even most conservative biblical scholars who tend to resist the documentary hypothesis today. I think most of them would find this persuasive.
Yeah.
I think there's also some indirect ways archaeology could come to bear. And actually, the Jewish scholar Joshua Behrman has done some work in this regard already. And there are others who are pushing and moving in this direction for source criticism already, insisting that our theories for how a text has come together and been constructed need to be grounded in the external realities we have from the epigraphic evidence.
Right.
And what we know about how texts developed in other cultures. Joshua Behrman turns to Egyptian texts that have been uncovered through archaeology and Hittite texts that have been uncovered through archaeology, and uses them as a type of comparison and control, and their literary history and development as a model for how we should look at the literary development of the Pentateuch.
And what's interesting is many other documentary hypothesis advocates have done the same thing, just sort of either explicitly or just implicitly. So, for example, the book of Deuteronomy contains a treaty form where God makes a treaty with Israel, a covenant with Israel, and the form of that treaty, the argument goes, follows the way that the Neo-Assyrian Empire made treaties with its vassals.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is archaeological evidence for the idea that the D source, the Deuteronomist source in the Pentateuch, is directly drawing on a specific historical and literary milieu or context. And because we have these Syrian texts, we can archaeologically demonstrate this is the case. So the argument goes. And so, yes, you're absolutely right, Neil. This is another way that you could indirectly demonstrate the plausibility of the theory by either saying, look, the D source, the Book of Deuteronomy, is relying on these Neo-Assyrian treaty forms. Well, wait a minute. What if we have earlier Hittite treaty forms that are more closely related to that, or Egyptian sources and so forth? So that's exactly another case where you could talk about archaeology verifying or converging with the documentary hypothesis.
Right. And again, that wouldn't prove anything, but and Behrman and others, even some on the more liberal spectrum, have been insisting more and more the documentary hypothesis doesn't fit with the kind of models of textual development we see in archaeologically discovered texts and traditions, whereas some other types of models would. And so that's just one way it could come into play. When we get back, we'll go ahead and we'll discuss some of the ways archaeology has come to support things in the Book of Abraham that were otherwise unknown in just today. So please stay with us on the Interpreter Show. And we are back on the Interpreter Radio Show. This week, I am your host, Neil Rapley. We have Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley here in the studio. And joining us by phone is Hale Swift. We're just wrapping up our summary of John Gee's presentation and some of the controversy surrounding it from the Fair Mormon Conference in 2018. At this point, I think we'd like to we've talked about a little bit about what the documentary hypothesis is and ways that archaeology could hypothetically at least come to bear on that theory of biblical composition. John Gee made the statement that the Book of Abraham has more archaeological support than that theory does. So why don't we just take a quick few minutes, and then we're going to move on to another highlight from the Fair Conference, to just summarize what is some of the archaeological evidence that there is available for the Book of Abraham. And since Stephen here is our resident Egyptologist, he got his master's degree in Egyptology from the University of Toronto, we're going to let him give us a quick rundown on that.
Right. So most of the archaeological confirmation we find comes from Abraham chapter 1. So Abraham chapter 1 talks about in the land of the Chaldeans, at Ur of the Chaldeans, Abraham was chilling out with his family, and there was some kind of an Egyptian presence or influence culturally and religiously because they were worshiping Egyptian gods up there and so forth. That's the setting of the chapter. So the question becomes, where is Ur of the Chaldeans? For a long time, and I have a big paper I've written on this that in BYU Studies that listeners can check out if they're interested. But for many decades, scholars have just sort of assumed or have taken for granted that Abraham's Ur has to be in southern Mesopotamia, at a site in southern Iraq that has the modern name of Tel El Mukyar, which is ancient Ur of the Sumerian Empire. Therefore, that must have been Abraham's Ur. The argument is gone. However, in recent years, there has been archaeological and other reasons to place Abraham's Ur not in southern Mesopotamia, but rather in southern Turkey or northern Syria. And that works nicely for the Book of Abraham because we have archaeologically attested Egyptian cultural influence or presence in Syria at the time. This would have been around the height of the Middle Kingdom of ancient Egypt, which would have included political and military dominance in the region, and some sort of a cultural contact through trade or diplomacy and so forth. So that works nicely for the Book of Abraham. Another archaeological convergence for the Book of Abraham is the idea that Abraham is going to be, you can say, sacrificed, quote, after the manner of the Egyptians, end quote. That's in Abraham 1. Well, we do now know that in Abraham's time and in other times of their history, the Egyptians would ritually execute enemies of Egypt in what are called execration rituals. You're execrating or driving out the evil influences or the evil chaos that foreigners and criminals and rebels bring into Egypt by ritually slaughtering them. And an Egyptologist at BYU named Kerry Muhlstein has published his dissertation on this, on what he calls sanctioned violence in ancient Egypt. And so we know that this was a practice that they did. Mm-hmm. And he's published on how this is similar to what's described in the Book of Abraham. There's also the issue of the names of the deities in Abraham chapter 1. Elkanah, Libnah, Mamakra, and Korash, which are four of the deities that are named as being part of this cult that Abraham, this religious cult Abraham is going to be sacrificed to. This has not been published yet. John Gee has just written on this preliminary in a manuscript that's yet to be published, but I can tell you that, without giving too much away, because I don't want to steal Dr. Gee's thunder, what I can say is that there does appear to be archaeological verification for at least three out of the four of these deities mm-hmm. listed in the Book of Abraham. Which isn't too bad, right? Given the fact that nothing was known about this in Joseph Smith's day, to have archaeological attestation of the names of these deities in the same time and place where we think Abraham's homeland was is significant. So just off the top of my head, there's a few things that I'm sure Gee had in mind and that we could talk about more, but this provides evidence for Gee's claim that the Book of Abraham does in fact have archaeological attestation outside of or independent of what's already been verified in the Book of Genesis, whereas the documentary hypothesis is lacking such confirmation.
Sure, and maybe just one last one worth mentioning is the fact that the Book of Abraham talks about the plains of Olishem.
Yes, that's another good one.
Which is now an attested toponym, Olishem, in the northern Syria area that Stephen was mentioning, mm-hmm. is arguably Abraham's homeland and geographically would fit very nicely
and that
with
goes,
the Book of Abraham.
And that goes along with the location of Ur of the Chaldeans because
right.
he says that the plain of Olishem was in the vicinity of Ur of the Chaldeans. And so
right.
the fact that we have archaeological verification for this place name is therefore evidence for the Book of Abraham's placing of Ur in the north as opposed to the south.
All right, and there's more that could be said about that, but we are going to move on. But first, it looks like we do have a caller. Hello, caller, you are on the line. Hello? All right, well, I guess they did not, they either hung up or they did not realize they were calling us. Maybe that was an accident. But if you would like to join the conversation at all, you can call us, 801-254-1640. At this point, though, we're going to move away from the Book of Abraham discussion. And Jasmine, why don't you tell us about this kind of landmark keynote discussion we had on the third day of the conference from Elder Kevin W. Pearson of the First Quorum of the 70.
I can start us off. Elder Kevin W. Pearson really just made a big splash at the fair conference talking about the importance of independent voices. And if you're interested, you can view an article with some of his comments on the Mormon Newsroom. The church did cover his attendance and address at this conference. He spoke about missionary work in the modern age, how we reach people. He essentially narrated a user journey. When someone's encountering the church, what are they going to do? They're going to Google it. They're going to ask their friends. They're going to go on social media. And he explained all of the routes that a typical person might go to when they're discovering the church or when they're a member of the church but have questions. And so he talked about how the church is seriously thinking about these things and wanting to make sure that they cover their bases and are available at every one of these routes on social media, on Google, that they're coming up in some of the first results when they have questions about the Book of Abraham or polygamy or any tough issue. And he wanted to make a point that the church can't do it alone and shouldn't be doing it alone. So often, he expressed, people are waiting for the church to do something. Well, I wonder if the church has written on this topic. I wonder if the church has something to say on this topic. And he emphasized that don't wait for the church to do something about it. We need people going out there, volunteering, researching, writing things, figuring things out, and publishing it online so that it's available. Not just one voice is out there, but multiple voices, multiple independent voices bearing witness of the truthfulness of the gospel in many different kinds of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, he really, really stressed that importance of having both, he said, independent organizational voices, things like Fair Mormon, like Interpreter, like Book of Mormon Central, More Good Foundation. I'm sure there are plenty more that could be named. Those are just the ones I feel comfortable naming them because he named them. And so I know those are ones he was talking about. But he also stressed the importance of having individual voices, individuals who are speaking up on these controversial topics. Of course, it's important. If you're going to speak up on this, make sure you're informed. Make sure you know what the church has said about it. Make sure you know what scholars have said about this. And try to be informed and aware. And you don't need to be a scholar. You don't need to know the ins and outs perfectly. I certainly wouldn't stress that. But be informed enough to make sure you can have contribute in a meaningful way to the discussion. But the importance of even having just specific individuals and individual voices out there on, you know, coming up high in the Google rankings, on social media, he stressed a lot, YouTube actually, videos that are positive, reflect the good and the positive side of the church, and discuss important issues in pro-church, pro-faithful ways. Are very important and necessary right now.
In fact, he brought up YouTube specifically because he talked about how especially younger people, like a millennial-aged investigator or a member of the church with the questions or doubts, if they Google something, they're going to see a bunch of articles. And they're going to look at those for 1 second and say, oh, I don't really want to read something. I would rather just watch something real quick. And so they'll go directly to YouTube. And that's why he brought up the importance of making sure that we have a presence on YouTube, that we are providing uplifting and meaningful and well-researched content so that people, as they're searching, they're not just finding anti-Mormon things or unresearched things, that they're finding good content to lift their faith or to just learn more about a given topic.
Yes, absolutely. Was there anything else, Hales or Stephen? Did either of you have anything you wanted to say about Elder Pearson's presentation?
One thing that was, I think, fairly significant is that he made the comment that he came there on assignment from the Quorum of the Twelve.
Yes, and specifically from the president of the Quorum of the Twelve. But yes, continue.
Yes. And so was very much delivering a sanctioned message that these kinds of so Fair Mormon, Interpreter, Book of Mormon Central, they're kind of like what NGOs are to governments. They're not the government.
Mm-hmm.
But they're these auxiliary organizations that help fulfill important needs that they've identified.
And just real
within
quick
the larger ecosystem. Yeah.
To clarify for listeners, an NGO is a non-governmental organization. And maybe if Hales would maybe like to provide an example of what people usually mean by that. But these are organizations that often operate within the international sphere, independent of any government or you know, national state organization, right?
Yeah, and sometimes they'll do things like providing education or providing, say, health services of various sorts or expertise in countries where those might be lacking.
Right.
And, I mean, that's very much what Fair Mormon does, right? They provide expertise on difficult topics to help people that are navigating an internal crisis of themselves or a friend or loved one or whoever from encountering information that they don't know how to deal with and need some help in knowing how to return to a place of stable faith. And they, in many cases, they've been fairly successful at that. Especially when the problems just come down to not really knowing or understanding the facts of the matter, then there's a large opportunity to improve. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what I got there.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to point out that Elder Pearson also made a point to talk about how important these voices are and how the church, obviously, as we've mentioned, wants to see this work happening. And these organizations do need help. They're run by volunteers. They're a nonprofit, and they need volunteer help. They need resource help. And he specifically said financial help.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's coming from a general authority. And so he said, you know, I'm not here to fundraise, but these organizations need help, and the church wants to see that help happening.
And he, you know, a lot of people, as you might imagine, when he wrapped up his presentation, in the Q&A session, a lot of people had questions about what are the trusted organizations, how should we be supporting them, is it okay to be using them in official church settings such as Sunday school, priesthood and relief society, seminary, and those kind of venues. And he stressed over and over again, yes, 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 please do, and how much he wishes and how much the brethren wish that these resources were being utilized more within those settings. He was even asked, why can't missionaries access these? He said, well, that's a good question. And I think that's something they're working on. And I wanted to maybe just mention, we've talked about already, if you want to listen to any presentation in the Fair Mormon Conference, you can go to the Fair Mormon website, fairmormon.org, and you can pay for streaming and you can watch any presentation you want. If you're particularly interested, though, in this presentation by Elder Pearson, this presentation is available for free on their Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to the Fair Mormon page. That's Fair Mormon, one word, FairMormon. And you can scroll down until you come to it. They broadcast that one on Facebook Live, and now it's available. You can watch it anytime on Facebook. So if you want to hear for yourselves what Elder Pearson had to say about the importance of independent voices, about trusted organizations that the church would like to see supported better, and whatnot, go to Fair Mormon's Facebook page and give it a listen. It really was a wonderful presentation, a great presentation, and we would definitely encourage you to do that.
And like the page while you're there.
Right. If we don't have anything else on Elder Pearson, we can go ahead and move on. One of the most interesting and exciting presentations in my mind was actually the one by Stephen Harper on the Making of Saints, the new church history volumes that are being published by the church. So far, the first six chapters have already been published in the Ensign serially over the last 6 months. And there's a lot of really exciting new information about those that were given to us by Stephen Harper, and there's a lot to talk about with that. But we actually, it looks like we have a commercial break coming up, and so just hang out with us here a little longer. Once we get back, we will be diving right into that. Traveling. And we are back on the Interpreter Radio Show. This week, I am your host, Neil Rapley. We have in studio here Stephen Smoot and Jasmine Rapley, excuse me. And joining us by phone is Hales Swift. Now, we mentioned just before the break, Stephen Harper's presentation at the 2018 Fair Mormon Conference, giving people background on the new church history that's coming out. It's going to be a four-volume history. It's called Saints. It's being published officially by the church, and we're going to tell you a little bit more about that in a second. If you would like to join this discussion at all, you can call us at 801-254-1640. But to getting back now to Stephen Harper's presentation, I think to appreciate how significant, how important this presentation was, this history that's being published is, you need to understand, the last time the church published a detailed official history was like 100 years ago. There's the history of the church, the six-volume set that was formally published by the church, started by Joseph Smith in his lifetime, and overseen by several of his secretaries and scribes who were compiling information. Didn't even come close to getting finished before he was martyred. His scribes continued the project, and it continued for quite some time until it ultimately fell into the hands of B.H. Roberts to edit and compile. And he finished it up in the early 20th century is when it was finally completed. And then B.H. Roberts himself goes on to write his own comprehensive history of the church, is what he called it. That was published in 1930. And then between then and now, other than, I think, the small Our Heritage volume that was published about 20 years ago, there's been no official history of the church published. As you can imagine, a lot has happened in the last 100 years or so. And a lot has changed. We've learned a lot more. New documents have come to light. And there's been a lot. And this, a lot of stuff that has been known by the community of historians who have studied Latter-day Saint history. And it's been discussed openly by those historians and occasionally even in official church publications. But there's been no one place to go to and find it. And so this, the first thing that's significant about this history is this is the church is finally putting it all together in one place for the average Latter-day Saint to read.
And Stephen Harper, in his presentation, presented a few purposes for this new volume, as Neil's already mentioned. One, to update it with, you know, the most recent happenings of the last 100 years. Another reason, to update the early church history with what we now know with recent new documents coming to light, more rigorous research, and also not shying away from some of the tough questions that saints have asked. They want to make sure this is as transparent and authentic as possible, and that they're addressing all the tough issues. Another purpose is to make sure saints around the world know the history of the church. Because while in the United States, us saints might take the history of the church for granted because we've grown up with these narratives, saints around the world have never had church history resources in their language, and the saints' volumes are going to be published in 14 languages on September 4th.
And those 14 languages, this is something that Stephen Harper stressed, those 14 languages provide this resource to 98% of Latter-day Saints throughout the world. 98% will be able to read it in their native language with just these 14 languages getting covered.
The thing that Stephen Harper said that I thought was very touching and very true is he said the first presidency wanted this to be in all these languages. Well, he first said when we asked for the budget initially to do this, we were expecting them like, okay, over time as we get the funds, we'll give it to you. And he said, no, up front, all at once, the first presidency said approved. It gave them the budget they needed to make sure that on day one, this reached everybody that it could as much as feasibly possible. The reason for that being, Stephen Harper said, was the First Presidency wants every member of the church to know that this is their history, they are part of it, this is their story, this is their identity. And so even if you are a first-generation convert in the middle of, well, the Congo, where Jeff Bradshaw was, and you're speaking French or an indigenous African language, you'll have this book in French so that it can be part of your story and your history. And so this is meant to be a worldwide history. It's supposed to be applicable to a worldwide audience and therefore a church-wide audience.
And that's a great point you make. And one of the things worth emphasizing about this history is it's not going to focus on the American church. It's not going to focus on just the prophets and apostles or whatever. They have repeatedly insisted this is going to be a representative history, and that's the word they've used, is representative. You can't cover everything that's happened in the church over the last almost 200 years in four volumes, even four thick 600-page volumes, which is going to be the size of this first one. But it's going to be representative, and they're going to be pulling stories from all around the world, from ordinary Latter-day Saints, to include and to talk about here. And so it's going, you know, everyone, their goal is to make sure everyone feels like they are part of this story.
And as we're talking about this, we're saying things like rigorous history, 600 pages, and I'm sure that scares a lot of people. But the other wonderful feature about this is that they've made saints not for the scholars. It's for the saints. And they've done that by creating a very easy to read, accessible, almost novel-like telling of the history. They haven't fictionalized anything, but as you read the chapters in this first volume, it's very clear that it reads like a story. These are characters. They've developed narrative arcs in the way that they're telling the church history. So it's fun to read. There's cliffhangers, and you want to know what happens next to Joseph Smith and what happens next to the translation of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, so in the very first chapter,
conflict resolution.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Go ahead, Tells.
Yeah, there's real conflict resolution. There are plot points. There are problems moving the story forward, and they really bring that out rather than documenting the weather and the condition of the roads, as it seems like some histories are wont to do.
Right.
Also, I think you'll find that these are not just stories from one class of people or just men.
Right. Well, and that was one of the presentations on Wednesday, was talking about women's stories that will be showing up in the Saints volumes.
Yeah, if I can compare what they're doing with this volume to modern pop culture. So the big craze these days is to create a cinematic universe for this or that franchise. So you have the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where they have Captain America and Iron Man and all these guys all thrown in together, and it's this big sprawling, multi-film, multi-franchise thing going on. This is the Mormon Cinematic Universe that they're doing with this. They're going to include almost everything in the kitchen sink in terms of telling the true story of the church, of the early church and the modern church. And related to that, which many people are probably wondering about, is, well, are they going to talk about the controversial stuff? Are they going to talk about the stuff that makes us squirm a little bit in our seats?
Right.
When we think of history? And the answer is yes. I had a chance to sit down with Ben Godfrey about a year ago. He's one of the a content developer, the Joseph Smith Papers. He's on their team, and I asked him, I said, okay, let's go down the line here. Multiple First Vision accounts. Is it going to be in there? Yes. Seer stones? Yes. Plural marriage? Yes. Book of Abraham controversy? Yes. Mount Meadows Massacre? Yes. You go down the list of all the stuff in church history that we traditionally have avoided or tried to sort of sugarcoat, and they're going to be tackling it head on, but not in a didactic, cold, mechanical way, but in a narrative way that situates it within, again, the Mormon cinematic universe, if you will, that situates it that way. Now, the other exciting thing related to that is what are called church history topics. So you have the gospel topics, which we talked about, then there's also church history topics. So when you're reading Saints and you find out that there were multiple First Vision accounts and you wonder, well, what the heck is going on with this? They will have, and they do have, an essay on the First Vision accounts of the First Vision, Joseph Smith's First Vision accounts. Mm-hmm. Or how about the divining rods and seer stones? Joseph Smith and others like Oliver Cowdery participated in this culture of folk magic, of using divining rods and seer stones. They have an essay on that. What about accounts of the Golden Plates? They got an essay. What about Joseph Smith's 1826 trial, where he was charged with a misdemeanor for being a glass looker, right? People thought he was a con man trying to trick people. They'll have a thing on that. So the main focus here is not necessarily just overtly apologetic, like just trying to explain all the difficulties. It is to provide a positive, faith-promoting story, but they will have the resources available for when you read about these things, you can dig deeper if you want to, and you can get a further handle on it.
And I think it's worth noting... you know, Stephen Harper, in his presentation, he talked about how, yeah, we're going to tackle everything we can in the narrative as straightforwardly as we can. But it's a narrative. And so, for instance, when it comes to, like, the multiple accounts of the first vision, they draw from all the different accounts. And you can actually already see this because this is in one of the chapters that's already been put out through the Ensign. They use the multiple accounts. But if you really want to learn about all the different accounts and whatnot, you go to the references. And Stephen Harper talked about the different layers here. You go to the references, which is one click away when you're in the narrative, when you're, if you're reading this digitally. And it's going to be online. It's going to be in the Gospel Library, all for free. You don't need to go buy this. But if you want to, if you're nerds like us, you can buy the physical volumes. But you don't have to. It's going to be there. And you'll be able to click, okay, here's the references. Here's all the sources for those different accounts. And here's the topics essay. And click, boom, you're getting a full topics essay on the different accounts of the first vision. And click, you're looking at the primary sources in the Joseph Smith histories, in the Joseph Smith Papers Project. However deep you want to go, it's just a couple clicks away. And you can be knee-deep in church history if that's really what you want to be doing.
And that, in part, is for making sure you can dive in if you want more information on a topic that you're reading in the narrative. But also the other point he brought out was, you know, sometimes we're creating this narrative of church history and we can't fit it all. And so that's also our way to make sure those issues are being addressed. For example, someone asked him the question, well, is the Adam God theory going to be in there? And he says, oh, you know what? Honestly, off the top of my head, I'm not 100% sure. But if it's not in the book, it absolutely is being covered in one of these church history topic essays.
And we had the chance to, Jasmine and I had the chance to be eating dinner with Jenny Lund, one of the presenters who also works at the church history department. And she mentioned that ultimately there's going to be 300 of these church history topics. Essays. 300 of them. Okay? So this is effectively going to be an encyclopedia, a church history encyclopedia that the church is putting out to make sure all of the most important and controversial topics are being covered in depth and are just a couple clicks away and are accessible for the common and average Latter-day Saint.
Oh, and if it hasn't been mentioned already, all of this has been directly approved and supervised by the First Presidency.
Yes.
This has, in fact, the book will begin with an endorsement by the First Presidency saying, we want all members to read this and to become familiar with it and to internalize it and thereby increase their faith. So this is not going to be some rogue historian doing some crazy thing, right? This is being directly overseen and authorized and supervised by the First Presidency. So in other words, we are moving into a new era of historical, of a transparency about our history coming from the highest leadership of the church.
Right. And in fact, the First Presidency message, which Stephen Harper shared with us, he had the First Presidency message up on the screen when he was presenting. He read it aloud. It's comparable to the First Presidency message that appears in our hymn books today. And so if you want to know how official this history is, it's as official as the hymn book that you use to sing hymns in sacrament meeting in. That's how official the history is going to be. Fully endorsed.
Revolutionary.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so that is it for today on the Utopia Radio Show. We hope you've enjoyed it. Again, what we can just plug, if you want to learn more or hear more about the Faramorn Conference, go to their website. You can still stream it online if you are willing to pay to get the streaming. Thank you, and good night.